Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. You can find him. Look up James Corbett. He'll tell you, he'll appear on the internet for you. James is broadcasting, he's speaking to us from Japan, and where he's been living for the last decade or so. And we'll get his opinions on a number of different political and economic issues over the balance of the program. And how are you doing, James?
I'm doing pretty well, Alfred. Thanks for having me on again. I'm looking forward to see what political and economic subjects we're going to tackle today.
Yeah, we'll see. First thing is, let's talk a little bit about something you probably haven't heard of before, Greece. In fact, you probably hear of it about every hour. What I'm interested in is I read a report from a credible source. I don't remember if it was the New York Times or Reuters or which it was yesterday, that indicated that even if the prime minister of Greece and the other negotiators acting on behalf of the creditors, if they reach an agreement today, on Thursday, which tomorrow, we're recording this program Wednesday night, on Thursday, there is supposed to be a meeting of the heads of state, not necessarily all of them, but the ones that are directly involved in these negotiations, and they would be the ones responsible for approving whatever deal the ministers came up with in the first place. Ministers come up with a deal today, they all say, I can live with this, but they don't really approve it. According to this article, the approval goes to the heads of government that would be meeting tomorrow at a summit. But even if they approve it, then the proposed agreement goes to the Greek parliament. And they have to approve this agreement. They might not. And if they don't, then the proposed agreement goes to the Greek people for another referendum. And my point is that there could be as many as four separate levels of approval before this thing becomes a done deal. First off, is my understanding about the four levels, is that roughly correct? And secondly, what are the odds that we're going to see an agreement between Greece and its creditors before the end of this month?
Well, as far as I know, what you laid out there, it at least could be a possible path to approval of whatever agreement they come up with. So right now, they are in a Eurozone finance ministerial meeting that concluded earlier today, European time, that's Wednesday, with no conclusive agreement, and they're going to be meeting again tomorrow, Thursday, so we'll see what comes of that. So that's the Eurozone Finance Minister meeting, but as far as I know, you are, of course, correct that it's not that the Eurozone Finance Ministers are directly going to conclude the agreement themselves with Greece. It's that this is going to be managed by the Brussels Group, formerly the Troika. So this is the European Central Bank, the European Commission, the European Stability Mechanism, and the International Monetary Fund are the four players at the table representing the creditors who are making this bailout deal with Greece. And so that they would ultimately be the institutions that collectively, I'm not sure what process they use, but they would be the ones ultimately approving this. And then, you're right, I think it would have to be ratified by Greek Parliament, obviously, whatever changes they're going to have to make in order to do this, what pension cuts or whatever they ultimately end up agreeing to. And I'm not sure the referendum is mandated at that point, but it certainly is a possibility. And I think this is what has, you know, we've seen over the past year or two, a lot of instability in the Greek political system because, you know, there has been a lot of kickback politically against the deals that have been made by the so-called leaders, the misleaders in Greece for the last few years. So it's certainly a possibility that that would happen and would destabilize things, but I'm not sure the referendum would be mandated. As to whether or not we're going to see a deal, I still think we are. Obviously, we came very, very close last week to getting one, and it's starting to fall apart, or seemingly so again this week. It's stalled, is the word they're using right now, because basically Greece has made some concessions in raising taxes and raising the mandatory retirement age to 67. But they're still haven't done enough in terms of cutting spending, according to the creditors. So I still think they're just hammering out the details now. And it looks like what we talked about last week with that odious debt, real bombshell that they dropped with through that parliamentary committee. It looks like that was just a bargaining chip, because they're certainly not using it in any meaningful way in their negotiations. They're continuing to negotiate with the creditors who their own parliament is saying is doing this illegal, odious, imposing this illegal, odious debt that should be null and void, but apparently not, according to Cyprus and the government.
All right, we've got one negotiation taking place between Greece and the IMF and the European Central Bank and so on. And it occupies, it seems, a disproportionate amount of news time and news print. But we've got another negotiation going on with Iran. And here's an article, and this is, we don't hear much, I don't catch much about this, but the New York Times, the headline is Iran's Supreme Leader, Khamenei, seems to pull back on nuclear talks. And he says, and the article says, with exactly a week left before the deadline for a final agreement to limit Iran's nuclear program, the government's supreme leader appeared to undercut several of the central agreements his negotiators have already reached with the West. In a speech broadcast live on Iran state television, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Khamenei, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, demanded that most sanctions be lifted before Tehran has dismantled part of its nuclear infrastructure and before international inspectors verify that the country is beginning to meet its commitments. My question to you is, what's been going on? This was a big deal. Oh my gosh, the Israel was perhaps going to bomb Iran. A bunch of things were happening. Some people said it was a terrible agreement. There were all sorts. This was much in the news several months ago. It's been much out of the news. And here we are up a week, within a week of the deadline, roughly the same, probably does have the same deadline as the Greek problem. What's been happening relative to Iran, and have the negotiations in Iran been intentionally obscured and not reported, so people didn't get involved anymore? I mean, we're all excited about Greece, and I'm not sure that it's a significant issue. Is Iran a significant issue?
Well, I wouldn't argue Greece is insignificant, but I think you're right. Whenever there is something that's concentrated on to such an extent, the question should always be, well, what aren't we hearing about? And I think you're very right. Exactly. Yeah, what's been happening with Iran and the Iranian agreement here has not been reported on very much at all, and certainly not made a lot of commotion about. So as a result, I myself am not up to date with this latest development. I do know, of course, back in April, as you say, there was this framework agreement that was cut between the Iran and basically the P5 plus one group. And that was part of that deal was to cut the Iranian stockpile of enriched uranium by 98% for 15 years, and also to cut the number of centrifuges that Iran was using in its program by 2/3 for 10 years. And this was supposedly the big breakthrough in negotiations and was going to be, you know, the framework for how we would proceed from here. But yes, as you indicate, and as I'm just looking at myself, yes, apparently this is now being put into question by Ayatollah Khamenei. So I don't have any details on what this actually means. Obviously, it was just a framework agreement that was reached and obviously requires ratification, and it seems that may be stalling. So I think that you're right. We should be concentrating more on this and what it could mean for really the future of the Middle East. Because as you say, during the hype about the framework agreement, the big story was, well, how is Israel going to react to this and are they going to bomb? Mm-hmm. So that's an ever-present threat that has been there for, you know, certainly for the last decade, and obviously for even longer, but it's a very real threat, and I think one we should take seriously, because of course this is part and parcel of the unveiling of the sort of nuclear first strike strategy that is now being brought into the open and sort of played with in terms of these nuclear bunker busters that have been developed to specifically for the Iranian nuclear program, and to try to get some of these deep bunker, you know, nuclear facilities that they're so concerned about in Iran. And so I think, you know, we really do have to look for the possibility of a flare up in these tensions and what it could mean for the future of warfare itself in terms of what they want to, you know, use a precedent for in establishing this Iranian threat.
How significant do you think nuclear weapons are, and how significant will they be 5, 10, 15 years from now? And where I'm going with this is, Are we coming to a point where it doesn't matter whether Iran has nuclear weapons or not? Could a sophisticated economy, a sophisticated intelligent people, could they figure a way to break into other countries' internet infrastructure, their computer infrastructure? And you don't even need missiles. Don't need nuclear weapons. All you got to do is, you know, attach your wires to their wires and make things happen on your keyboard. I don't imagine that we'll ever get to a point where we don't have nuclear weapons. But I wonder if they're going to be as fearsome and perhaps predominant in the sense that they are today. What do you think about that?
I think they will always be a central point of international geopolitics, just by the nature of these weapons and how they've been developed and how they're deployed. They do still present a very real threat. I mean, if they were ever actually employed.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you knock out whole cities.
Exactly,
and the rest of that.
Right.
It's not
well,
a small thing.
Well, depending on what we're talking about, because not only do we have these big ICBM, you know, warhead-type massive nuclear weapons, we also now have the development of the B-6111 and other tactical nuclear weapons that, again, I think they're trying to ease out into the public view so that they can basically make it politically acceptable to use tactical nuclear weapons. So these are just small blasts, one half to six times the size of Hiroshima. It's just a minor nuke, or so they want you to believe. And, oh, the consequences would be minor. There wouldn't be much fallout, which, of course, was refuted back a decade ago by the Union of Concerned Scientists, who had a report on that showing that nuclear bunker buster on an Iranian nuclear facility would have catastrophic effects with in terms of the fallout that it would produce, and they did some modeling of the ways that fallout would fall, and likely affecting hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in the direct vicinity of that. So it is, I think, still important in both of those ways. I think you're right that even regardless of whether or not some terrorist organization or whatever can come up with some sort of mini suitcase nuke, even the idea that the nuclear powers that we think of as the nuclear powers are the only nuclear powers is increasingly becoming a joke because, Saudi Arabia, for example, we know has a deal with Pakistan so that they sort of have nukes on order in case they ever need them. So Saudi Arabia isn't technically a nuclear power or isn't admitting to being so, but they kind of are. And arrangements like that. And of course, you know, who comes under the American nuclear umbrella, who comes under the Israeli nuclear umbrella, which officially doesn't exist, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, all of these things, which show that I think, yeah, the idea that this is a small and confined nuclear club and will stay that way is itself just a fundamental lie.
But again, even if it does stay that way, and I don't believe it will, the more sophisticated weapons may wind up being electronic and digital. You know, viruses or whatever that can be implanted.
Right, I see what you're saying.
Nation's infrastructure
right.
And so on.
Yeah.
And that could come from anywhere. I mean, China is working hard on it. They may make a breakthrough that will just astonish everyone. Mm-hmm. They could put us all back in the Stone Age if someone understands how to fry all the CPUs in this country.
That's right, yeah.
And without firing a shot.
Exactly right. And in fact, that is actually part of the nuclear talk these days as well, is the idea of using a nuke not to destroy a city, but to, as an EMP burst that over a populated area could just fry the electronics of, you know, millions of people and make them completely useless. I mean, it's not something repairable. It would just fry all of these electronics. And obviously, in our day and age, that would send people back to the Stone Age, basically. And imagine, you know, all these people without any electronics, let alone their iPhones and whatever gadgets they're so fond of these days. It would be a nightmare.
There would be no games.
Exactly.
I couldn't play solitaire on the internet.
Exactly.
What would I do with my life?
No bread and circuses app to distract
absolutely.
People.
Absolutely. Run out of bread and no freak lunches or circuses. Yeah, you know, they had bread and circuses back in the days of Rome. Now we have free lunches and video games. It's the same theory. It's just a little different presentation. Where are we for time? We've got, a minute and a half here. Let's just get started on. I have a third item here. We can touch on it. Maybe I'll just express this to you and you can think about the answer, and then we'll take the commercials and we'll get your answer when we come back. Here's an article from the New York Times. NATO refocuses on the Kremlin, its original foe. And the article is essentially saying that NATO is once again uniting in a way where it will focus on Russia as if, as it previously did on the Soviet Union. We'll get your take on that when we return. Let's take our commercials, and I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival. Be back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be here in just a minute. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, thecorbettreport.com. Brought up a headline from the New York Times. NATO refocuses on the Kremlin, its original foe. The article says, in part, after years of facing threats far beyond its border, NATO is now reinvigorating plans to confront a much larger and much more aggressive threat from its past, Moscow. The seismic shift has been apparent in military training exercises in this former Soviet republic, which is now a NATO member, and they're talking about Latvia and on the alliance's eastern flank bordering Russia. So in keeping with the theme we sort of started this program out, we've got a lot of activity concerning Greece and a lot of information, and we seem, look at Greece, look over here, look at Greece, look at Greece. In the meantime, we're not paying much attention at all. We've lost track of Iran. And I'm wondering, is this article where they're suggesting that NATO is becoming more aggressive or defensive but better armed with regard to Russia than they have in the past, is this article exaggerated? Is the subject something that's been concealed and obscured by all the, you know, the interest in Greece? Is it cause for concern, or just, you know, another bump in the road?
Well, I think the article isn't exaggerating. There is a real and demonstrable sense in which NATO is ramping up its forces and its ability to execute, well, basically a war in Eastern Europe. And in fact, we've seen so many different steps along that path. The most recent in the last couple of days that NATO defense ministers are announcing a NATO response force of 30,000 to 40,000 troops that they are attempting to get ready to deploy in Eastern Europe as part of a rapid response spearhead force, whatever that means. And it's pretty interesting. And of course, they're using the justification that Russia has just announced an increase in its nuclear arsenal. So they're calling it nuclear saber rattling, and they're using that as basically the excuse for the ramping up of this rapid response force that they had first announced, I believe, last year. But now they're ramping it up to 30,000 to 40,000 troops already. It's a pretty significant force. And it's just, that's just the latest data point along the path. In fact, another interesting development, the Nuclear Planning Group of NATO, which was established in the 60s as part of the Cold War to coordinate defense plans against the Soviets, is going to hold an additional meeting in the coming weeks, which is a very unusual thing for this group, which obviously didn't seem to have much of a reason for existing for the last couple of decades until the recent talks started to ramp up. And of course, we'll remember back in the height of the Ukraine brouhaha, we had the risible former NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen calling on NATO countries to increase their spending for their NATO contributions. So we've seen all of those things, and we've seen other ridiculous stories. Like there was the story of the submarine that Sweden was trying to track down in their waters that was apparently some Russian submarine that was, you know, coming as part of some, if not invasion force, maybe they're just scouting or testing defenses or whatever. So there was this big story about it, and they even held NATO exercises, a sub-hunting exercise as part of the craziness about this. But oh, it was quietly revealed in the back of the papers a few months later, oh yeah, that's Russian submarine, actually it was just a civilian boat, and yeah, it was all a false alarm. So those are the types of stories. So I think there really is a response we're seeing from NATO. There really is an actual effort to ramp up their forces, but I think it is a largely, if not hyped scenario, at least they're certainly making advantage of any and every excuse that they can in order to do this. And I think it's really, I mean, you could pin it down to NATO just trying to to become bigger, to expand, expansionist. But it's also, of course, part of that growing Cold War narrative that we're being asked to believe in. And of course, I have my own reservations about that narrative. But there's a sense in which it's a real demonstrable political reality that is being funded and brought into existence by these types of ridiculous stories.
You know, a year ago, we had the United States trying to foment sanctions against Russia, which they've managed to do based on the annexation of parts of eastern Ukraine. And these sanctions are there, but I had the impression at the time that the European Union didn't really want to cooperate. They get their natural gas and some of their crude oil from Russia, and they have no interest in rocking the boat. They're not concerned about the Ukraine. Ukraine's not their problem, and they do want to keep a steady supply of petroleum products, and Russia was their guy. All right. Now we see the European Union, well, NATO, but as a practical matter, to me, it looks like the European Union is saying, no, we're prepared now. We're going to build up a 30, 40,000 man army to bump heads with the Russians if we have to. They are, from my perspective, they've gone from where they were opposed to the U.S. idea of sanctions to where now they're embracing them. Am I understanding? Do you think that's a valid understanding? And if so, what does it signify?
Well, yes, absolutely. We should point out that, yes, they've just extended this or re-extended the sanctions against Russia, which has caused a bit of, you know, rancor in from the Russian side. So, yes, I mean, there is clearly an embrace of these sanctions that clearly are against European interests broadly, because, of course, Russia is a good trading partner with Europe. I mean, they certainly supply a certain amount of export and import goods for the Europeans, both in terms of manufacturing and in terms of what they can ship in. So it is kind of shooting themselves in the foot. But I think we run the risk of doing exactly what they want us to do, which is to think that the European Union is Europe. Of course, the European Union is a group in Brussels that dictates reality to all of these different countries, many of whom are, I think, still actively against the shooting of themselves in the foot that clearly is part of this saber-rattling with Russia. And one, I think, very clear example of that was when the European Commission scrapped the South Stream project, basically saying it violated certain European business regulations. So they scrapped that. And of course, that was going to provide direct economic benefits to Bulgaria and Hungary, Serbia, Austria, as that pipeline, you know, went through that area. It would have brought a lot of benefits to those economies. So when the European Commission scuttled it, obviously those countries were very unhappy, especially Bulgaria, Hungary, that, you know, this could be a significant thing for their economy as scuttled by the European Commission. So I think, yes, the European Union, the European Commission, Brussels is very much supportive of the U.S. sanctions and the saber-rattling, but I think the periphery is not so. And this is a big pressure point that obviously Putin, I think, is aware of and probably going to try to use to his, you know, biggest possible advantage. And we saw that in the Greece brouhaha, as right in the height of these bailout talks, Tsipras goes to St. Petersburg and meets with Putin and gets a 2 billion euro deal on Turk Stream, which is the replacement pipeline for South Stream. So there's definitely some pressure points and some ways that we can definitely put our finger on to say that the European Union is not a coherent entity, and there is a economic and political reality that's being dictated from Brussels that a lot of the European countries are trying to buck against.
Let me pose another question to you from another great American philosopher, Rodney King. And the question is, why can't we all just get along? I mean, it seems like they were getting ready to get along between Russia and Europe. They're going to work. Now we can't. Why is that?
Yes, this is a good question because it goes right to the heart of the issue. And the point is, who does getting along benefit and who does not getting along benefit? And it's quite easy to say. I mean, it's always the case. War is the health of the state or the health of the contractors, the defense contractors and others who directly benefit from this. I mean, there's so many different groups that have an interest in creating tension, even if it doesn't lead to wars. Just the tension itself can be very profitable and very advantageous for various groups. I mean, the European Union as an institution benefits from this as well. If there's some sort of perceived threat from Russia, then people will say, oh, I hope the European Union will help, you know, keep order and sanity. If our lightweight politicians don't want to do it, I hope the European Union will come down and create some sort of, you know, response force and maybe a European army. I mean, that's the type of thing that becomes feasible when there is some sort of perceived threat. So there's always, unfortunately, a market for threats. And what we're seeing is the creation of the next boogeyman.
Yeah, that's probably correct. The creation of the next boogeyman. I remember when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, and you would think there'd be cheering and, you know, parades and whatever in Washington, D.C., and they impressed me as being almost sullen. I mean, they were upset that they'd lost their boogeyman. What then? Well, we had to create another one. It's called terrorists and the rest of that sort of thing. But the government needs its boogeyman. It's like a kid needs a teddy bear when he goes to sleep at night. The government needs a boogeyman or they can't sleep properly at night. Where's my boogeyman? Here's another one. Matter of fact, I saw two articles. I have one in front of me. And I saw one that I don't have in front of me right now, but a Russian official has asked for an international investigation to discover why it is that the original film of the moon landings for the United States have disappeared. Apparently, it's been admitted by NASA that they, in order to make space, they disposed of the tapes of the original tapes of the moon landing or landings on the moon, and they were thrown out with 200,000 other tapes they had. And this is like MGM or whoever owns the master copy of Gone with the Wind saying, we threw it in the trash the other day. We were just taking up space. You don't get rid of Gone with the Wind. You don't get rid of the movies that depict the first landing on the moon. How could this have happened? And is there something suspicious about this?
I would say so, yes. I mean, for people who don't know about this, so I believe it was about a decade ago, some NASA employees were looking for the original raw format telemetry data of the slow scan television telecast of the moon landings and found they were missing. So, yes, apparently they've been erased or reused or somehow, you know, in some archive mix-up, just can't be found anymore. So, yes, they don't exist. So I know this controversy over this fact has been around for at least a decade now, and it's interesting that Russia is bringing this up, because
Russia wants to know. And they say, we're not saying they didn't land on the moon. Mm. We're just saying, you know, where is this stuff? And
very
the implication is if you could subject these videos to modern technology, digital technology, you'd be able to discover and prove right very quickly that we really did land on the moon or we really didn't. And yet the tapes are gone. And supposedly so are about 400 pounds of moon rocks that they hauled back. They're also supposedly missing, and the Russians want to know where are the moon rocks.
Right.
Want to make sure they didn't.
And some of the people who got the moon rocks did some testing and found they weren't moon rocks at all. So, yes. Yes. Well, let's put it this way. I personally think that there's no doubt that the footage and the photographs have been manipulated and faked in some cases. And I don't think that necessarily means that we never went to the moon, but it certainly means there was some shenanigans going on with the tapes themselves. And maybe it means we never went to the moon. I don't know. But absolutely, there is some shenanigans that have gone on with that. And it's just interesting that if what you're saying here is the Russian official is bringing this up. Of course, we're not saying they didn't go to the moon, but isn't it interesting this is missing? Because that speaks to I think a point that a lot of people probably have about this, people who have questions about Apollo 11 and things like that, why don't the Russians speak up about this? It's the same thing, in fact, with the War on Terror boogeyman. Why don't the Russians speak up about some of the things that they absolutely do know regarding collusion between U.S. officials and various terrorists? And we've seen hints of that. There was a recent documentary about Putin and in which he stated, you know, about a decade ago, we did record some communications that were taking place between high level U.S. State Department officials and terrorists in the Chechen movement that were taking place in Azerbaijan, but you know, nothing came of that. A very interesting little omission, because for people who know about the story about Gladio B and the collusion between the U.S. and various terrorists in Central Asia, I mean, that's a significant thing that Putin kind of sort of let out a little bit. It's almost like they're trying to, you know, signal to people in the know, you know, we have information that you probably don't want released, so you better watch what you're doing. And that's I think, the surface level reading of that type of thing anyway.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and we have another article here from Bloomberg Business. And the headline is, Bank of Russia says fear of Fed surprise keeps markets on edge. So even the Bank of Russia, they're concerned that the Federal Reserve is going to surprise us by raising interest rates, and this is what's keeping the markets on edge. And it's just interesting to me that here we have Russian officials meddling in what would seem to be domestic American financial issues. Any comments? Bank of Russia?
Yeah, well, welcome
to the Federal Reserve.
Welcome to the world markets, which is really what we're living in. And it makes sense. I mean, every country in the world should be watching what the Fed is doing and how it's going to go, because that will affect absolutely every country in the world in the same way that just their announcement that they would start to peel back the QE3 led to such volatility in foreign markets, like in India, where you had that plummet of the rupee. As a direct result of the money unwinding back into the American system. I mean, there's no doubt we're in a globally connected system right now. And what happens, you know, if Washington sneezes, the world catches a cold. So, you know, of course they're going to be talking about that. But I'm just looking at this article now at Bloomberg. Bank of Russia says fear of Fed surprise keeps markets on edge. It's interesting to see that these comments were made during a presentation of the regulator's financial stability report. And there's a PDF online. So I'll take a look at that and see what else they say in there.
All right, James, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. You're going to be on vacation for the next several weeks. Is that true?
Yeah, I'll be out of town for the next few weeks.
Yeah, you'll be out of town for the next couple of weeks. Secret destination? Or
No. Actually, we're taking my son back to Canada for the first time, so it will not be a restful vacation. I'm sure it's going to be very, very active, but it should be nice.
Sounds like fun. Have a good trip, James. We look forward to talking to you in about a month. I'm Alfred Addisk on Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with good Lord, bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Seems to be a single penny left for me.